As the coronavirus spreads across the globe, many governments are taking actions to minimize the threat.
There's not a kind of coordinated global strategy. There were times when the U.S. played a certain role, but if we look at whether it's Africa or Asia or Latin America, the U.S. role recently has been far diminished, and that's actually undermining capacity worldwide.
I'm Arun Vanagopal, and today on The Takeaway for January 28th, we'll check in on how prepared countries around the world are for the outbreak. Also, we look into the Trump administration's new rule that would roll back environmental protections on U.S. waterways.
It strikes at the heart of health protections that Americans have enjoyed for decades and, frankly, taken for granted.
Plus, we'll look into the U.S.-India relationship ahead of President Trump's upcoming visit.
He's been making comments about Kashmir and been offering to mediate, which, of course, India has rebuffed. But it's also going to be interesting what stance he takes on his business deals in India.
Got a lot of news to get to. Let's get started. Across the world, there is a growing sense of alarm over the spread of the new coronavirus. As of today, the virus, which originated in China, has infected at least 4,500 people and killed more than 100. China has implemented a broad series of travel restrictions that includes a reduction of flights and trains to the mainland. They've also placed bans on travel visas. However, the virus has spread to at least a dozen other parts of the world, including Thailand, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Australia, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and France. Here in the U.S., roughly 110 people have been evaluated for the coronavirus, and so far, 5 people have tested positive. As fears over the virus continue to spread, it raises new questions about how prepared countries around the world are, not just for this virus, but for the next pandemic as well. For more on this, I'm joined by Matthew Kavanaugh. He is an assistant professor of global health and director of the Global Health Policy and Governance Initiative at Georgetown University. Matt, welcome to The Takeaway.
Arun, thanks for having me.
Also on the line, we have Shan Li, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She is currently under quarantine in China's Hubei province. Hi, Shan.
Hi, nice to be here.
Shan, you fled Wuhan, where the outbreak started a few days ago, along with millions of other people, correct? What was that experience like?
It was a really, really chaotic day. They announced the lockout in the early mornings of Thursday, and I found out because my editor woke me up at 3 a.m. in the morning. I ended up running to the train station originally to interview people, and then ended up taking one of the final trains out of the city to Beijing when I realized I didn't have enough protective gear. It was just a kind of a scene of chaos at the train station as people woke up to the news that if they didn't get out by 10 a.m., they weren't going to get out of the city.
What is the part of Hubei province that you're in right now look like?
So I'm in a city called Xiangyang. It's about 200 miles northwest of Wuhan. It is also under lockdown, which is part of the reason why we're stuck here, my colleague and I. It's basically like any second tier city. And right now there's just very few cars on the roads. There's very few people walking outside, which is quite unusual for Lunar New Year, which is when millions of people, you know, travel home to visit family, and it should be a really joyous time of the year. But now everyone's just staying at home for fear of being infected.
And you've been told to monitor your health constantly, right, by taking your temperature and the like?
Every 4 hours, and we're reporting it to local authorities in case we might be infected as well. We're under quarantine for 14 days.
How effective has the Chinese government's response been to the coronavirus so far?
I think that's a matter of a lot of debate. So obviously, China wants to be seen as a global leader in world health, but you can see just in the hospitals in Wuhan, they're just being besieged by patients. They're really overwhelmed. Hospitals are taking to social media to plead for basic medical and protective gear like face masks. And there's a lot of questions about whether the healthcare system in China can handle it and whether the overall system, if there's enough transparency to handle an outbreak like this, whether the government is disclosing information in a timely manner to the Chinese people.
Matt, how well do you think the Chinese government has responded to the virus?
You know, it's interesting. There's as was said, a lot of debate. One of the things we know is that authoritarian regimes can kind of have pluses and minuses, right? And so the Chinese regime, for example, is able to lock down 56 million people, close down cities, able to build hospitals in, you know, in a week or two. That's remarkable, and that's the remarkable amount of control that's shown by an authoritarian regime. But at the same time, information flows have been really challenged, right? So one of the things we've noticed is that the information coming out of China has often been wrong, right? The earliest cases were far earlier than originally reported. A lot of the cases were not linked to the market that was reported. There was human-to-human contact transmission way earlier. It's far deadlier than we thought at first, not just for the sick and the elderly. So a lot of that information has been flowing really poorly. And that's actually explained often by, you know, an authoritarian regime where people are afraid to share information. It discourages local officials from raising bad news with their central bosses. The lack of transparency and media results in a lack of trust. So a lot of those information flows are actually really not working nearly as well as they should be.
Sean, what are conditions like for the residents affected by these lockdowns? Are they getting the supplies they need?
In Wuhan, at least, you see that people are sheltering in place. So there's a lot of uncertainty about when the lockdown is going to end. So they've been rushing to supermarkets to clear out shelves of food and water and basic sort of like face masks, gloves, things like that. It depends on elsewhere, like under cities like partial lockdown, like Xiangyang where I am, there's still people who can kind of go out and about and it feels slightly more normal and there's less panic. So it really depends on where you are, what kind of lockdown you are.
And are you seeing Chinese citizens publicly criticize the government over their handling of this pandemic?
Yeah, that's been quite interesting because Chinese media are actually reporting that about how quickly the virus is spreading and that the situation is deteriorating. And there's been criticism of the local authorities in Wuhan and how they've been handling it, which is quite unusual in terms of Chinese media being allowed to report such things and not being censored. So that reflects, I think, the deep anger among a lot of Chinese people for how this is being handled. A lot of people are very angry and taking to social media to criticize how the government has been, basically throughout this entire process, has been handling the matter.
So we've seen a lot of travel shut down. You mentioned the Lunar New Year when normally hundreds of millions of people should be on the move. Imagine many of them are staying at home. What does this virus mean for the Chinese economy?
It's potentially going to have a huge impact. So we saw during the SARS outbreak in 2002 and 2003, China lost about 10 million jobs. And this could arguably have an even bigger impact on both the Chinese and global economies. So, you know, we can obviously see that the Chinese consumer is an even more integral part of the world economy increasingly. And we're already seeing it hitting tourism. Like you mentioned before, countries like Russia are canceling tour groups from China. Philippines is suspending visa upon arrival. Hong Kong is cutting off a lot of connections with the mainland. Even Hong Kong Disney and Hong Kong and Shanghai Disneyland are closed. So that's affecting tourism. And then internally, these are millions of people being locked inside their cities during the busiest travel time of the year. So it's just having a huge impact on tourism and the service sector overall. And that will spill over into other areas as well.
Matt, looking beyond the coronavirus and to pandemics in general, the 2019 Global Health Security Index report found that national health security around the world is weak. What are some of the main reasons for this weakness?
So critical capacities that are needed are things like laboratory capacities, things like enough healthcare workers to be able to respond, pieces like isolation units and beds in hospitals, et cetera, the basics of a healthcare system. And what we see is that there's, you know, most countries around the world are really challenged to have kind of focused on that because it's far easier to worry about a pandemic when it comes rather than become prepared. And that's been a huge, you know, oversight. We've seen kind of for years the United States government, for example, every president since Jimmy Carter has actually seen a major international outbreak. But instead of really getting ahead of things and really creating a global health strategy that's able to respond, you know, in a holistic way, what we've seen is increasingly just we wait until one pandemic happens and then we respond and we respond ineffectively. That's got to shift.
And which areas of the world do you think are most vulnerable to pandemics?
So what you see is that low and middle income countries are by far the most vulnerable, right? They're places where there's insufficient numbers of healthcare workers, there isn't the lab capacity, and there isn't the financial capacity to really address that. You know, we've been thinking a little bit about some of those pieces, and what we see is kind of three big things, right? You've seen today's pandemics, AIDS, TB, and malaria continue to be a major problem around the world. They're killing millions. But then you've also got increasingly these new pandemics or new outbreaks that could become pandemics, plus you've got the effects of climate change that are coming through. All of that really needs to be addressed, and yet there's not a kind of coordinated global strategy. There were times when the U.S. played a certain role, but if we look at whether it's Africa or Asia or Latin America, the U.S. role recently has been far, far diminished, and that's actually undermining capacity worldwide.
In a paper that you co-authored at the Journal of International Affairs, it reads, "The oft-repeated reality that diseases know no borders reveals why an approach rooted in international solidarity and multilateralism is needed." To be honest, that doesn't really feel like the U.S. at this very go-it-alone moment. Is this really just a shift during the current administration?
So look, either during the current administration or an administration to come, what we know is that that isolation and walls and borders are just really ineffective, right? Right now, what we're seeing is, you know, attempts at screening at borders, which is, you know, the last worst option when it comes to addressing pandemics. Instead, what we should be talking about is how do we proactively halt pandemics? You know, in that paper, we found the U.S. spends 0.19% of all the budget on pandemic-related global health efforts, and that is tiny. And the Trump administration has been moving every year to try to cut that amount. And so I think a return to a U.S. that is engaged is critically important, and it's going to be the only way that we effectively address pandemics writ large. You know, the least effective strategies are those that are often being deployed at the last minute. The most effective is where we think about the global South, we think about how we stand in solidarity, and we think about what the U.S. role is critically going forward. That's not just financing, it's technical cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of that is not happening, and that's actually making Americans less safe and people around the world less safe.
Have there been pandemic success stories?
You know, there's a couple, right? And so, you know, we've seen smallpox eradication is one really good example. And again, that was a bit of a global coordinated effort. The response to HIV and AIDS recently has been a success in many ways, although we've recently taken the kind of attention away and the foot off the gas, and now we're seeing in some countries a resurgence of HIV and AIDS. So we need to learn the lessons from those, which is being proactive is far more effective than being reactive when we let things get out of control. You know, frankly, as we did in the 80s with HIV, as we have done on tuberculosis, and now in some ways, right, what we're seeing is a reaction to this disease, which is, you know, trying to move after it's out of the gate a little bit. We have a real problem.
Sean, real quick, you're stuck in a hotel room in China. What are you waiting to see from the government in the coming weeks?
How they'll continue handling the outbreak, and whether, you know, whether they can really stem the tide of the spread of the outbreak, and whether when the lockdowns of the cities are going to stop, because eventually, you know, Lunar New Year is going to end and people are going to have to go to work. These are millions of people who are going to have to migrate home and possibly carry the virus with them.
Sean Li is a China-based correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Matthew Kavanaugh is director of the Global Health Policy and Governance Initiative at Georgetown University. Thanks to you both. And Sean, stay safe.
Thanks, Arun.
Thanks, Arun.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway. The financial industry is starting to worry about the impact of rising seas, wildfires, and investors who care about going green. The world's largest money manager, BlackRock, announced recently that it had plans to make climate and sustainability a central part of its investment strategy. This comes at a time when asset managers are facing more pressure than ever from shareholders to take climate into consideration. And just last week, a report issued by an umbrella organization for the world's central banks argued that climate change could cause the next financial meltdown. We spoke with Emily Chasen, sustainable finance editor at Bloomberg, about how much of a difference a move like this could make for BlackRock and investors, and whether this is the start of a larger trend. This all started with a letter written by the chief executive of asset manager BlackRock, Larry Fink, What did he say?
So Larry Fink, this was sort of his second or third iteration of what this asset manager with $7 trillion in assets can do on the climate. So before, he said, I want companies to have a social purpose. And that was really kind of about attracting millennials that work for the companies. But now it's much deeper and stronger. And he says, this climate crisis is going to affect investment returns sooner than we think, and we need to put that at the center of our strategy. So they laid out sort of a plan of how to start doing that. They want companies to report more on climate and their pathway and whether they are set up for a 1.5 degree world or a 2 degree world of global warming. They also said they're really going to push companies on fossil fuel exposure, especially coal.
Big picture, how consequential is this?
So BlackRock manages $7 trillion. So what they said is they're going to take coal out of their actively managed funds. Passively managed funds are the biggest part of their business. The actively managed funds and coal, people have estimated this is probably about a $500 million position that this affects. So on $7 trillion, it's pretty small. But it is pretty significant because they're actually one of the largest funders of coal worldwide when you think about their huge impact. BlackRock owns a piece of almost every public company, often 5 or 6% of every public company. So they do, when they speak, they really, you know, carry a big stick.
Is it safe to say that this is symbolic, but that symbolism is significant?
Well, this is the most strategic and most specific they have been yet on climate change. So I think people in the industry are interested in that. There have been a lot of people pushing them to make changes. Their investors have wanted them to be much more clear about their proxy voting and when they go to a company, what they're really saying about climate change. But this is where they said this is a real financial risk and we're going to make an effort in that. So hopefully, you know, it'll all depend on how they deliver in the end.
Tell us about Larry Fink. I mean, how much of an environmentalist is he?
Yeah, you know, he's been talking about this for a while, and he was just in Davos this past week, and he was actually wearing a climate data scarf that we noticed. It had sort of the warming from the whole industrial period, and each thread of the scarf was a line of heating and color-coded. So at least he's wearing, you know, they say you should walk the talk. But in the asset management industry, there are quite a few investors that have been much more aggressive on climate change than BlackRock. So people will really be watching to see if he actually makes changes in his voting. They did sign up for the Climate Action 100 Plus group. So what BlackRock's going to do is vote with a whole collection of $41 trillion of investors that are really pushing the 100 largest emitters on their readiness for climate change.
How has this announcement been greeted by the financial industry?
People have really paid attention. BlackRock is such a significant holder of companies. The financial industry really cares about what they say and what they do because it doesn't affect their passive funds, and passive funds are such a huge part of the market. There is some skepticism, especially from the longtime responsible investors, but we'll just have to wait and see.
There's also some people who are watching this and they're just kind of rolling their eyes. They're sort of blasé about this, correct?
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting about passive funds and investing in general is a lot of people set it and forget it, right? You don't really think about the long-term consequences of what you're investing in and what you're funding in. So it's great to see that asset managers are starting to pay more attention to that.
Emily, let's step back for a second here. Can you explain for us how the financial industry and climate change are actually connected?
So socially responsible investing has been around for a while, right? But it's really taken on this climate element more in the past decade or so, where investors are really concerned about the impact of environmental risks on their portfolio. So there have been social movements in the past, right? Like, you know, people protesting about the Vietnam War, the kind of way that people are in the streets today protesting about climate change.
Or apartheid in the 80s.
Exactly. And in apartheid, they divested. And there's this big divestment movement on climate change and divesting from fossil fuel producers. But also, climate change is a huge set of business opportunities. So climate change is actually a problem that you can invest in.
So is the idea here that there is a critical mass when it comes to sustainable forms of energy that is making it increasingly attractive to divest from coal and the like?
If you look at a company like Exxon, they used to be in the S&P 500 top 10 for about 90 years. Last year is really the first year they fell out of the S&P 500. So it is getting to be a smaller part of the market, and this traditional energy structure is getting to be a smaller part of the market. There's a lot of debate about how exposed you need to be in your portfolio to energy, whether you can replace that fossil fuel exposure with renewables. Renewables are also have their challenges, right? There was the clean tech bust of the 90s, and solar costs are coming down and wind costs are coming down. So it can be a little tricky. A lot of these companies are startups. Mm-hmm. But there's increasing evidence that you don't need the kind of energy exposure in your portfolio you used to have.
So does this mean that when somebody like Larry Fink talks, that investors will perhaps look a little more closely at investments at companies that they may not have paid attention to before.
Well, this is a sign that climate issues are a mainstream issue for sure. BlackRock hasn't said something so clear about what they want to do on this. They have been privately pushing companies sort of behind closed doors in their meetings saying, you know, I think you should be more active on this, or you should be more careful about this kind of strategic risk. But they haven't been so clear about incorporating into their strategy, and it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Did BlackRock do this because of pressure from activists, or more because it's in their best interest, financially speaking?
Yeah, you know, ESG in this whole area of socially responsible investing, it is really interesting about whether is this, you know, a way for people to preserve their assets and get rid of risk, or is this a way to change the world? It's probably somewhere in between on both of those. But, you know, BlackRock has faced a lot of pressure this year from the government, from activists who blocked it, exits to its entrance this year, from its own investors who put forward shareholder proposals asking them to clarify their voting on climate, from their fellow investors in the industry, right? They've been facing lots of pressure. Definitely that was probably part of the reason they wanted to act. But also it seems like they just say this is good business now.
Let's look at the Trump administration. They're pulling back from all kinds of agreements and environmental regulations that have been in place for close to 50 years. Clearly, there is a section of corporate America that is not in alignment with the Larry Finks of the world. Is he being pulled in that direction as well? Is there a contingent of the industry that's saying, like, no, that's just kind of like that's identity politics or what have you?
What's interesting about the Trump administration is that there is that physics problem, right? Like for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And so having less influence in the government on this area has sort of put the onus on companies and investors to say, hey, you watch out for these risks, and to be much clearer about the risks that they face. And so that is something that's happened ever since Trump entered the office, that the investors have said, hey, you know, these are risks that we have. And if the government's not watching out for us, you better watch out as a company. That's a lot of pressure for companies. Some people don't really want companies to have that role in society. But if not them, then who?
Oh, that's fascinating. So is this the start of a larger trend?
So there's about $30 trillion in assets that people consider sustainably invested in some form or another, whether they just avoid gun stocks or they avoid fossil fuels or they actually have a full strategy for incorporating ESG. That's about $1 in $4, $1 in $5 invested globally. That's quite a big portion of the market. So having BlackRock added to that group, if they really are serious about this, that is definitely a sign that these are mainstream concerns.
Annamalee Chasen, Sustainable Finance Editor at Bloomberg. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Across the country, millions of miles of waterways may now be more vulnerable to pollution as a result of a new rule from the Trump administration. Last Thursday, the Environmental Protection Agency and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers finalized a policy gutting federal protections for smaller bodies of water like streams and wetlands. Larger waterways like the Mississippi River will continue to be protected. The new rule is just the latest attempt by the Trump administration to chip away at environmental regulations in the U.S., which we've been following here on The Takeaway. For more on this, we're joined by Blan Holman, senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center. Blan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Glad to be with you, Arun.
Simply put, what is the impact of this new rule?
It's a major, major reduction in protection for the United States. More than half the streams in the U.S. are now at risk of increased contamination. And in the South, we're putting at risk drinking water supplies for 32 million Americans.
Under this policy, what types of waterways are still protected and which ones are now vulnerable to pollution?
As you mentioned, the view of the administration seems to be that the United States government should only protect the largest streams, so the Hudson River, the Mississippi River, and that the upstream tributaries really should not be protected by the national government. And it's a little bit like saying you want to protect your heart, but you don't care what happens to the capillaries, the arteries and the veins. And, you know, there's famous sayings about what runs downhill, water runs downhill, and certainly pollution with it. So if your concern is the Mississippi River and these large water bodies, you need to be concerned with what is happening upstream.
So what sort of pollutants are we talking about here?
The heart here is the Clean Water Act. So the Clean Water Act was enacted in 1972, and it, for the first time, established basically a shield over our waters in the United States. And the way it works is you can't pollute into streams and wetlands and rivers unless you have a permit. And to get a permit, you have to clean up your waste. So be it, toxics or sewage. So this applies to all kinds of pollution, and they're shrinking the shield. To take an example would be in the news, there's been a lot of discussion of things called PFAS or PFAS, polyfluoroalkyl substances. These are substances that are human-made chemicals that are showing up in drinking water across the country with very serious health effects. You need a program to require polluters to clean that up before they're discharging into creeks and streams. You need to control it at the source if you're concerned about drinking water. And that's exactly the kind of discharge that would be unregulated by the federal government if this rollback sticks.
And what is the Trump administration's justification here?
It's an ideological theory that the national government has no business protecting smaller streams and wetlands and should only concern itself with big rivers that you could put a steamboat on. It's kind of an old world view of what the national government should be doing, and it disregards science entirely.
So how long have these protections been in place?
Through multiple administrations, Bush administrations, Clinton administration, Reagan administration, Nixon administration. So this isn't just undoing recent protections. It's going back to the 1970s and removing protections we've had for decades.
The Clean Water Act was passed during the Nixon era, and President Nixon, as I understand, initially vetoed it. But were congressional Republicans more likely to support environmental policies back then?
I think so. And back then, what you were seeing was the result of inaction. The Cuyahoga River in Ohio had caught on fire because of pollution. And so Congress acted understanding we needed a national approach to a national problem. And so for this administration to say, hold on a minute, let's leave it to the states to pick this up. Really, that's what Congress meant to fix. The states weren't doing the job. And certainly down here in the South, we understand the states are hamstrung by small budgets and a lack of political will sometimes, so we need the national floor.
Who does this new rule help?
I think it's the bone being thrown to fossil fuel industry. People running the EPA are former fossil fuel lobbyists, so it's no surprise this would help them.
Are there specific regions or types of communities that'll be more affected than others?
Sure. I'll give an example down here in Charleston, South Carolina. We've got repetitive flooding in a part of our city where the city is buying out homes that have been flooded repeatedly. This rollback will allow developers to fill wetlands upstream, and wetlands absorb floodwaters. An acre of wetlands can absorb 1 million gallons of floodwater. This lets them fill more easily those wetlands, which means more floodwaters downstream, which means more damage and more wreckage to people's lives.
As someone who does live in South Carolina, do you feel like this is resonating beyond environmental circles?
I think, you know, we all drink water and we take it for granted in the United States that what comes out of our tap, that someone is working to keep it clean. We do think of there being a background of protection and we take it for granted.
Some states are counteracting the Trump administration's overhaul of environmental protections by passing policies on a statewide level. Is this an effective strategy?
Well, it's a good thing to see. Of course, in 1972, Congress was faced with states that were doing a hodgepodge of protections. And the hodgepodge really doesn't work if your goal is to have a national floor of protections. So if you have a national floor, you're setting a level playing field for the states. And it prevents states from looking at their neighbors and saying, maybe if we had slightly weaker laws, we could attract more business. And water, of course, goes across state lines. So that national floor and the uniformity it provides, it's good for public health and it's frankly good for business so they know what to expect.
As someone who devotes your life to protecting the environment, how does this cumulative impact feel for you?
I think it's frankly, a little disappointing and frightening as someone with children who grew up enjoying these kind of protections and seeing the economy of the United States prosper even as we had environmental protections. It's really disappointing to see that being thrown out the window and our families be exposed to more pollution as a political favor, essentially. So it's disappointing, but, you know, that's why I do what I do, and a lot of folks do what they do, is it's time to stand up and to insist that the laws be followed and that our environment and our health be protected.
Glenn Holman is a senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway, and we close out our hour today with a conversation following on our coverage this week of unrest in India and here in the U.S. With growing diaspora activism against the Indian government and a push for U.S. action against India's discriminatory citizenship law, the relationship between Prime Minister Modi and President Trump is once again in the spotlight. Late last year, Modi visited the United States for what was coined a Howdy Modi rally in Texas, just weeks after implementing a wide communication shutdown in Kashmir. The event drew thousands of Indian American supporters. Now officials say that Trump will likely visit India next month for a similar town hall celebration, as social unrest continues to grow both here and in India over the country's new citizenship law. For more on how the history of the relationship between Modi and Trump relates to the current situation, we now turn to look at the political ties between India and the U.S. with Milind Vaishnav, a senior fellow and director of the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And also with us is Anjali Kamath, an investigative reporter at WNYC. Thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thanks.
Thanks, Arun.
Milind, we saw such a huge turnout when Modi came to the U.S. last year. What kind of support does he have across the Indian diaspora?
So, Arun, we don't have any hard empirical data about, you know, say, what percentage of Indian Americans support Modi. But what we do know is that he does seem to enjoy broad support. Indian Americans, by and large, see him as a powerful leader, as someone who wants to propel India into great power status, as someone who has the leadership, the guts, the charisma to kind of take tough economic decisions at home. However, what's been interesting is that, you know, the Indian American population, of course, is not a monolith, and we're seeing a lot of interesting cleavages, most notably age. A lot of young people are coming out against Narendra Modi and some of his more hardcore nationalist agenda. And, you know, Indian Americans are not the same as Hindu Americans. And I think often we make that conflation, obviously, with Hindu Americans providing greater support to Narendra Modi than other minorities.
There is a paradox I'd love to explore with both of you, which is that voter surveys of Indian Americans suggest that they're strongly in support of Democrats, and even on issues like a travel ban, that they overwhelmingly oppose it. Yet at the same time, as you describe, Milind, you have this very strong support for relatively anti-Muslim sort of policies in India. How do we reconcile these two things?
So I think, you know, from the position of most of the diaspora, they're really kind of looking at a very macro view. And this is what they're seeing when they look at Mr. Modi. They're seeing as somebody who shares their view that India for a long time has been a big country, but it hasn't been a particularly important one when it comes to global affairs. And Modi really taps into this idea that India is a civilizational power that should regain its rightful place at the kind of global community roundtable. So much of the diaspora emigrated to the United States because of frustration with the lack of economic opportunity, the kind of cronyism, corruption, graft that's so rampant across India. And they see Narendra Modi as someone who's willing to take decisive, bold leadership in order to rectify that situation. And so I think, frankly, not many of them support a lot of these interventions that he's made on the social and cultural agenda necessarily, but they're willing essentially to make the trade-off saying that in the long run, we take the good with the bad, and there's more good than bad in their view.
Yeah, it's also interesting, you know, historically, Indian Americans have tended to vote Democratic by and large, even though there have always been sections that have voted Republican. But, you know, even at the Howdy Modi event that you just mentioned, I mean, I spoke to several people who had friends and family in Texas who were sort of thinking about whether to go. And one of the sticking points was, even if people kind of liked Modi, they were turned off by the fact that President Trump was going to be there.
Milind, let's talk about the relationship between Trump and Modi themselves. What's the history there?
I think it's worth stepping back, Arun, to the early 2000s, which is really when the beginnings of this U.S.-India strategic partnership start to form. And so we've seen it kind of blossom under successive presidents, beginning with President Clinton, then George W. Bush, then Barack Obama, and now Donald Trump. So Donald Trump essentially is following along a path of kind of broadening and deepening this relationship. And believe it or not, people who are close to both the prime minister and the president say that they managed to strike pretty nice rapport in private when the two leaders meet either in bilateral meetings or on the sidelines of other global summits. But that's not to say that there aren't some real sticking points in the relationship. And I think one of the biggest ones is economic. This president has made trade and trade deficits a huge issue with almost every country that we do business with. And India is no exception there. And so he has been willing to put that issue really at the forefront and say, OK, well, we want to move together with India on defense, on science and technology, on economic growth and all these other things. But we really need to get this issue settled first and foremost. So that has now sort of taken center stage as a potential thorn in the side of the relationship. The issues around democratic freedoms, civil liberties, things that are being discussed and debated both among the diaspora and amongst Indians at home is not exactly at the forefront of the Trump administration's foreign policy agenda right now. And so while it does get some airtime, I don't think it cracks even the top three issues on the bilateral agenda.
Anjali, Trump has had significant business ties in India. You've done extensive reporting on this. Can you give us a quick primer on that history?
Yes. You know, the Trump Organization's largest overseas portfolio is actually in India. They've got five different projects, and they've been in India for almost a decade now. You know, their first project started in 2010. And Don Jr. has made about a dozen visits to India, even as recently as September, right before the Howdy Modi event. Don Jr. and their Indian partners had flown over 100 buyers from India to New York to come meet him and have dinner at this golf course in the Bronx. And he talked about how, you know, once his father is out of office, he'd like to continue making deals in India. But these are active deals. I mean, there are five projects. Only one of them is complete. And all the other projects are still under construction. There's a couple of them just outside the capital in Delhi. There's one in Mumbai. There's one in Pune. There's one in Calcutta. And the interesting thing is the partners they've selected. You know, all of the partners have a really checkered history with the law and a history of government investigations into pretty serious allegations of fraud, bribery, even money laundering. Three of these partners are very closely tied to the ruling political party, to Prime Minister Modi's party, the BJP.
What does this mean for people over here?
I think it's definitely raised a slew of questions among people who've been closely following the ethics about these kinds of deals and about the line between business and politics. On the one hand, it raises a lot of questions in a country where corruption is quite rampant in the real estate industry. You know, right after Ivanka Trump made a visit to India in November of 2017, you saw the permits being fast-tracked for a Trump Organization project very close by to where Ivanka visited. So you see this kind of nexus where mm-hmm. you start to wonder what's driving what. Is it the business interest? Is it the politics? Is it the ideological interest? And then, of course, there's the big picture strategic issues that Milan is talking about, right? Whether or not Indian Americans here like that or agree with it, there is a certain section of BJP supporters in India who like that very much.
Milan, what about the broader relationship between these two countries? We don't have to go back too far to a time when Modi wasn't even allowed in America, correct?
When Modi was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, which is one of the most prosperous states of India located in the western part of the country, in 2002, there were horrific riots which broke out on his watch in which over 1,000 people were killed, the vast majority of whom came from the minority Muslim community. On the basis of that violence, the U.S. government decided to revoke his visa in 2005 under a what was at that time kind of an obscure statute on international religious freedom. So from about 2005 to 2013, the U.S. government, as a matter of stated policy, had no engagement with Narendra Modi. Now, that all changed in 2013 when it became very clear that in the 2014 Indian general election, the BJP was likely to be the single biggest party and Modi was likely to be India's next prime minister. And I think the Obama administration at that point in time did, I think, what most U.S. administrations would have done, which was they got pragmatic and said, well, we're going to have to do business with this guy, so let's start to lay the groundwork. And so Modi, after becoming prime minister, could have spurned the United States, but he chose not to. He also took a more pragmatic path. And by all accounts, he and President Obama were able to work through this troubled history. And so the broadening and deepening of U.S.-India ties from the early 2000s pretty much continued, if not hastened, under President Obama and Mr. Modi.
You mentioned the travel ban against Narendra Modi prior to becoming prime minister. That was in part the result of work by members of the diaspora here. Are you seeing right now sort of a jousting happening in D.C. and elsewhere in terms of trying to influence how legislators approach India, given all the protests that are happening right now in India?
We absolutely are. And you have to place this in a larger context. Since Modi and his party were brought back to power in the spring of 2019, they have moved with a certain clarity, a certain urgency about enacting some long-standing objectives of their kind of Hindu majoritarian agenda. And I think this latest fracas over this legislation has raised the temperature. So we are seeing intense lobbying happening on the Hill. We are seeing protests. And I think we're seeing politicians respond. Whether or not that's going to fundamentally change the trajectory of the relationship remains to be seen. I think by and large, the administration still has adopted a kind of realpolitik view that we have bigger fish to fry. But as the situation grows more concerning in India, I think we're going to see more legislators, more governors, more members of Congress speak up.
So, Anjali, Trump is most likely visiting India in just a couple weeks. What do we expect from this visit?
There's a lot of talk about how this visit is going to be about the trade deal and finally making some progress on this ground. And it will be interesting to see what he has to say about the protests, what he has to say about Kashmir. I mean, he's been making comments about Kashmir and been offering to mediate, which, of course, India has rebuffed. But it's also going to be interesting what stance he takes on his business deals in India, because this is going to be his first visit to India since 2014.
I would just say that I think that people are going to be watching this really closely, not just for the trade issues, which I agree with Anjali are going to be the primary substantive goal of the bilateral meetings, but there's this larger symbolic messaging which could take place. And, you know, frankly, if you go back and you look at the past several years of Trump's interactions with strong men, illiberal or autocratic leaders, or people who somehow violate the spirit, if not the actual rules of democratic practice, he has often taken their side. And so this could have, you know, larger reverberations. And I think we're all waiting to see how it exactly plays out.
Milan Vaishnav is Senior Fellow and Director of the South Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Anjali Kamath is an investigative reporter at WNYC. Thanks to you both for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for us today. It's been good having you with us. Hit us up at The Takeaway on Twitter and check out everything on thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.